From the Sky News Centre at 5, Ed Miliband's being criticised for linking the Prime Minister to North African migrants dying in the Mediterranean. Anna Jones reports from Westminster.
After insisting recently he is up to being a world leader.
Hell yes, I'm tough enough.
Ed Miliband's focus today on foreign policy, suggesting David Cameron's lack of planning after military action in Libya contributed to the migrants crisis.
This could have been anticipated and it should have been avoided.
The Prime Minister's not impressed.
His remarks are ill-judged.
Nigel Farage says the military action destabilised Libya.
We bear, Ed Miliband too, a very heavy degree of culpability for what's going on in the Mediterranean today.
Nick Clegg's described the comments as distasteful.
Meanwhile, a man accused of being the captain of a migrant boat which capsized in the Mediterranean, killing 800 refugees last weekend, has appeared in court. Mohammed Ali Malik and another man claim they were passengers and not part of the crew. Britain's youngest ever terror suspect has appeared at the Old Bailey over an alleged plot to attack targets in Australia. The 14-year-old was arrested in Lancashire. A man's to stand trial over the brutal murder of an 82-year-old woman in North London last autumn. Nicholas Salvador's pleaded not guilty to beheading Palmyra Silva in Edmonton by reason of insanity. Prince Charles and Prince Harry have attended events in Turkey, marking 100 years since the Battle of Gallipoli.
Good afternoon, good morning.
This is Jerry Built Radio. Who fought in one of the deadliest campaigns of the First World War.
Thank you.
It may be we shall never swim again, never be clean and comely to the sight. May rot untombed and stink with all the slain. Come then and swim. Come and be clean tonight.
And finally, HSBC says it'll take its time over a decision whether or not to move its headquarters out of the UK. It's thought the bank's looking at the idea to potentially reduce its tax bill. That's the latest. I'm Annie Joyce.
Love Bristol.
Love.
BCFM 93.2.
It's Friday, it's 5 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling. This week we go a full 2 hours with councillors from some of the main parties, Conservative, Labour, Lib Dem, Greens and UKIP, all invited. I'll be asking some of the questions gleaned from the last year's political reporting and giving all today's participants a chance to talk about their vision for the city. Along with the five parties, Bristol has former merchant venturer mayor, of course, George Ferguson, who describes himself as an independent. And there's also several Independents for Bristol candidates standing in these local elections. And we'll be hearing from one of them, Dawn Parry, too, in about half an hour. In addition, Trades Union and Socialist Coalition, Left Unity, English Democrats, British National Party and Vapors in Power candidates are standing too. Some in the BCFM area, but some also outside the Bristol city boundary. That's in the general election and in the local elections. On to our election debate in a minute, but first Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 11 degrees Celsius, dry and breezy. This weekend, highs of 16 Celsius, sunnier on Saturday, heavy showers possible though throughout the weekend. Next week, highs of 11 Celsius, sunshine and showers next week, and next weekend, that's the 2nd and 3rd of May, highs of 10 degrees Celsius, sunshine again and showers next weekend. That's Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So, around the table, we have representatives from some of the main parties standing in Bristol City Council's local elections. All five main parties have been invited. For the Conservatives, we've got Jeff Gollop. Labour leader, group leader, Helen Holland has also been invited, but is not here yet. Also for the Lib Dems, we've got leader, group leader Gary Hopkins, and also Tim Malnick. He's a Green councillor. Finally, Michael Frost is the UK Independence Party councillor. He's also been invited. Hi, all of you, and welcome to BCFM's Local Election Politics Show.
Hi.
First of all, I'd like you to begin by going around the table and ask each of you in a couple of minutes to tell us what your party's vision is for Bristol and how you intend to bring it about. First of all, you, Jeff Gollop, from the Conservatives.
Right. Well, the first thing I think really important for Bristol is we've got to create jobs. We've got to create a situation where the city continues to grow and flourish, create the jobs that can actually provide the infrastructure and what we need to make this city prosper. But more importantly than that, we've actually got to get this city moving. And that means sorting out the transport arrangements in the city. I think everybody agrees a lot needs doing, but one has to question, first of all, whether a blanket 20-mile-per-hour zone is the right thing for every part of the city. One's got to question whether residence parking zones are being operated in the way that is best for both residents and for the businesses that make our city prosperous. And we've got to look at what we do to actually make the city work better, more sensibly, more wisely. We've got challenges as well in dealing with housing, because as the city prospers, we need to make sure we can accommodate those people we need to work in the city. And we've got to make sure that we are not just, going back to my initial comment, not just creating jobs for those at the higher end of the job spectrum. We've got to actually be looking to be creating apprenticeships and opportunities for all.
Well, we had a bit there, Jeff, but you've given those main things, jobs, transport, housing.
Yep.
But the key is, how are we going to actually make these things happen? We've got these aspirations. That's fine. How are you going to implement them?
How are we going to implement them? By actually looking at making our policies user-friendly so that they produce the end results. Too often we see local government making decisions without fully examining all the consequences. Because if I just come back to one of my pet themes at a smaller local level, I think the council policy on libraries is quite ridiculous. We see ourselves closing out a service that is important to some of our most vulnerable people, and we're not delivering that effectively and wisely. And I use that as a prime example of how we can reconsider what we do and make sure we do it a darn sight better and a darn sight more cost effectively.
Okay, Gary Hopkins for the Lib Dems. I'm going to ask you the same exact question. Tell us in a couple of minutes, what's your party's vision for Bristol and how you intend to bring it about?
Well, the first thing to say is that Bristol is one of the most innovative cities in the world, and actually that helps to create jobs. And one of the things that the City Council have got to do is then sometimes get out of the way and allow business to actually get on and grow. Having said that, there's a concern that geographically the city is rather split, in that the north and west of the city are prosperous and parts of the south don't share in the prosperity of the rest of the city in quite the way they should do. Now, one of the ways of tackling that is to improve links and communications across the city, and then we get back to transport. Basically, we do need to have a properly controlled transport system. We invested a lot of public money a few years ago in improving the network of bus lanes, etc., and I'm afraid that we've completely failed to get the dividend back from First Group in particular. And really, the Mayor now needs to get a grip of that and take hold with quality bus contracts, which would move the service forward quite dramatically. Our education service, which was a few years ago extremely poor, is now moving forward rapidly, but we've got to keep that pace going and keep the focus on improving educational attainment for all. Clearly, the disadvantage a lot of the schools actually suffered has now been partly eradicated. The National Pupil Premium has helped there, but basically there's a huge amount more still to be done. We've also got to have a sustainable city, because a circular economy is actually in the long term the right way to go, and we were making quite a lot of progress on that. I'm afraid one or two of those things have now slipped backwards over the last couple of years.
Now, Gary,
and we need democracy, which again is under danger in the last couple of years.
You've highlighted education there, but really the City Council's losing control of education, isn't it? It's slipping out to the academies, where they're controlled from central government and the local authority doesn't get involved.
Yes, I think there's a balance to be had. When we were actually running the council, we did not, in actual fact, object when a few academies came in, and it helped to move things forward. But when we have the present situation designed by Michael Gove, where the city council is effectively barred from getting involved positively in education, but still has duties to supply the number of places, etc., it really is a bit of a bizarre situation.
So, you're talking about you want improvements in education. How do you do that, though, practically? Because you've starting to lose control of it.
And it does make life more difficult for the City Council. It doesn't mean to say that it's got to give up completely. I'll give a small example. I was a governor for both my local infants and junior schools, both of which have been in special measures. What we actually managed to do with the help of an education advisor was persuade the two bodies to come together into a primary school, attract an absolutely top quality head, and that moved the school forward at a tremendous rate, and the momentum is now actually there. And bits and pieces of help and advice from the City Council can make a huge difference.
OK, Gary. Helen Holland from the Labour Party just arrived while she's settling down. Let's hear from Tim Melnick. Tim, tell us your vision, the Green vision, Green Party's vision for the city, and how you intend to bring it about.
Sure. Well, maybe, Tony, first I'll introduce myself, because I'm sitting here with some very senior members of the council who at various times have or are running the council, or bits of it. And I just want to say to your listeners, I've actually only been a councillor for 1 year, and about 2 or 3 years ago I'd never even thought of becoming a politician, and I still find that quite an odd thing. So there are some advantages to that, I think, which is this year I've learnt a lot from seeing how it works, and I've come at it with a very open mind. So in terms of the Green view, I think we have to be very honest, and actually all your questions about how would you do things that you've already asked to Jeff and Gary, we have a national context of austerity with some incredibly strong cuts that have hampered what local authorities can do. We have a mayoral system in this city, which, again, my understanding is, in my first year as councillor, again, limits the real decision-making power of many councillors. Now, that's not to avoid your question, but I think I should be realistic as a member of a smaller group and a councillor exactly what we can do and what residents should expect any party actually to do. So here's what my vision would be. The first thing is councillors, I think Green Party councillors are incredibly conscientious, incredibly hardworking, and do respond first and foremost to the needs of their local communities. And a key Green principle nationally and locally is that all politics should be driven much more from the grassroots. So whether that's about localisation, whether that's about devolving funding, or whether that's about forming policy not through a party ideology but listening to what people want, we're very big on that. In terms of some of the specific things that Jeff and Gary have mentioned, everyone would agree jobs is important, everyone would agree transport's important. So in terms of jobs, what Greens will always lobby for is an absolute diversity of different sorts of organisations and businesses. We would absolutely promote and do promote social enterprise, voluntary sector, and we don't think really jobs should be just driven by what large companies want to do. There's a lot of evidence you create more jobs for your money by supporting local economies, so we support local high streets, etc. Part of that then is about transport. If you have vibrant local high streets and good transport, people will get to all sorts of jobs. So in terms of transport, we're big supporters of the Bristol Cycling Campaign. There's evidence that just for £16 per person per year, you could get the whole city cycling around, and that would really free up a lot of the traffic and have a lot of health benefits.
But Tim, yes. I mean, you mentioned this right at the very start when you started speaking. As a quite a small party in the city, how are you going to actually make these things happen?
Yeah, well, it was your question, and I was trying to frame the reality of it. So what we would do as a group is we will choose certain issues that we want to lobby on strongly, and largely I think our influence is through lobbying the mayor, working with local campaign groups to put certain issues on the table, and also through roles which maybe a lot of your listeners won't know about, but the role of scrutiny. Scrutiny is where members of all parties get to hold the executive to account, and it's possible there to shape policy making. So I think that's a realistic answer.
Okay, Helen Holland, you're the group leader for Labour here in the city. What's your vision for the city, and how are you going to make it happen?
Well, I think, Tony, that what you see, and what we've seen particularly over the last few months while we've been out on the doorsteps and talking to lots of people, is that Bristol still is a very, very divided city. And the story that is told about Bristol is not the story that is many people's daily experience. They don't feel the growth, the buzz that some people talk about. And partly that's a reflection also about what we're hearing nationally. We keep hearing that everybody's feeling better off. Well, I talk to people day in and day out who definitely don't. And I think what Labour councillors have some experience of doing and will continue to do while we still have the current mayor is to make sure that the voice of those people whose voices don't get heard in College Green do get heard, and the story of Bristol is one that those people who feel very excluded from a lot of what's going on, that they can relate to, and that they can see that politicians are fighting to get things that really matter to them. And jobs and homes and transport, some of the things that have already come up, those are all, I would say, in crisis. There are people who are excluded from the jobs market. There are people certainly who are excluded from the homes market, and not enough has been done to deliver new homes. And there are people who live on the periphery of the city, whether that's in South Bristol, in my own patch, or North Bristol, East Bristol, who find it incredibly difficult to get around the city, to use public transport. And so I think that all of those things are things that really matter to people here. And we've shown that even with a mayor, and as Tim has said, councillors' power is limited under a mayoral system, but we have shown that we've managed to get this mayor to move from a position during the mayoral hustings, and Jeff was there as the Conservative candidate at the time, and he'll confirm this, that the mayor was utterly unconvinced about the importance of the living wage, for example, but bit by bit in the City Council, by bringing motions, petitions, constantly raising it at the HR committee and so on, we've got the mayor to agree to Bristol becoming a living wage city. And that's progress, but it's not all the progress that we could make, because one of the things that we're now pressing for is, great that we've done it in the City Council, but we could do it in the council's contracts, which would affect hundreds more people if we were able to do that. And the mayor at the moment is not committing to doing that. So I think what was shown is that although the power resides with the mayor, there are still changes that you can make, both by putting pressure on, political pressure, and the lobbying that Tim's talked about. But at the heart of it, you've got a mayor who doesn't understand that this city is a very divided one.
And how are you going to deliver these things? I mean, it's all very well having a vision. How do you intend to make them happen?
Well, there are all sorts of ways that you can make them happen. And one of the things I think that we've recognised is that because a lot of the power about jobs and employment and skills training rests with the local enterprise partnership now, and the City Council doesn't have very much influence over the local enterprise partnership at all. So we'd want to look at how the local enterprise partnership was run, and to make sure that they understood that the priority is about getting skills and training to those people who are excluded from the jobs market at the moment. So that's one thing. We'd make sure that that those Sure Start centres that have been put under pressure by cuts in children's centres within the City Council, that those are properly funded, so that you get that early start, which is all about childcare, and it's about better outcomes for children, so that when they do get to schools, which, as Gary has already said, schools are better performing now, but again, it's patchy, and we want all schools to be good schools. Those are some of the things that we're very committed to doing. And then obviously there's, I've already mentioned it, but the housing crisis, 14,000 families on the council's waiting list, and hardly any houses being built at the moment. So we really need to make sure that we get on with building decent housing. And given that many people have to live in private rented sector, it's about the ethical lettings charge.
Okay, thanks.
Well,
thanks, Helen. That's Helen Holland. There's the group leader for the Labour Party on Bristol City Council. Also joining me for the Conservatives is Jeff Gollop, Tim Malnick for the Greens, and Gary Hopkins for the Lib Dems. Michael Frost for the UK Independence Party, who's a local councillor, was also invited, but he's not here. One of the biggest changes in the city for many years has been the bringing in the mayor. And I'm going to go around you all now and ask you your thoughts about, he came in, George Ferguson was voted in 2012. There's going to be another election next year, along with council elections, which are going to have all city councillors, 70 of them as well. So this is the last local council election where there's only going to be, I think it's around about a third of the councillors elected. So it's a big question and big ask, and I'll give you a few minutes to ask you all of you. And I'll start with you, Tim Malnick, for the Greens. What are your thoughts about whether the whole implementation of bringing a mayor into the city has been a success or otherwise, and also about the change in the electoral system that's coming on with everybody being elected all at once? Because there is a difference, isn't there, between the electorate getting a chance every year or every couple of years to re-elect councillors and send a message to the politicians and the political parties, and doing it all at once.
So I'm smiling because I'm looking around thinking, you think we're all looking knackered now, you wait till next year when there's 70 councillors up for re-election. So there's two questions. You've asked about the mayor and about the way that councillors will be elected differently. And as I mentioned at the beginning, I'm in a different position from the other speakers today because I haven't experienced life pre-George. Well, I've experienced life, but not political life. But that's actually been very interesting. My first council meeting, there was a review of the constitution and a lot of debate about how that was all changing. So I bring a certain perspective. It's worth saying that the Green Party were the only party who campaigned initially not to have a mayor in the referendum. And the reason I believe that. Is that not true?
Well, I think you'll find that the vast majority, both Labour and Liberal Democrats, also were not happy about having a mayor.
Okay, well, I stand corrected. That's what I thought.
Our
view of that was that whoever that person would be, the role, it actually, the danger is it puts too much power in the hands of a single person in local government. And I think in a situation where you have 70 councillors who will represent different proportions and have different perspectives, to have one person, whether it's political or not, is inherently dangerous. That's no judgment on George.
But do you think it's worked? What's your sense?
Well, I think it's, you know, it's not a yes or no answer. What I hear from people locally, people who know the city and for officers, is that most of them would say that there had been a history or a perception in this city that there was an awful lot of political argy-bargy between different parties and different ruling groups for whatever reason. And there has been a perception, I think, internally in the council and from the public that things really didn't progress quickly, that they didn't happen, and that was maybe one reason why we wanted a mayor. Now, I think George actually does make certain things happen, whether it's what people want to happen or what the people around this table want to happen, that's a different matter. We've got RPS now. Most cities in the country have had that for quite some time. We're pushing forward with an arena. So in terms of a single person being able to make things happen, I think it works. My problem is the lack of real democracy and a sense that, you know, as Helen's alluded to, as councillors and the different groups don't always feel that more than lip service is paid to the different perspectives we bring from the city.
Okay.
And I think
Gary Hopkins for the Lib Dems, what are your thoughts about the mayor, number one, and number two, the change in the way that we're electing local councillors here?
Well, basically, I think the mayor as a concept is fundamentally flawed from a democratic point of view. The vast majority of our party were against that, although we did allow people freedom to say what they wanted and whether they thought it was a good idea or not. We also think that the present administration has been bad for the city in quite a number of ways. I mean, people were persuaded by a combination of the local newspaper, Tory ministers and the present mayor that extra powers would come to Bristol, extra money would come to Bristol, which of course they haven't. And then they were fed, you know, quite frankly, a completely different version of what might actually happen than what actually has happened. And we were very much, having seen what's actually happened, huge numbers of people, a lot of whom actually voted to get a mayor, a lot of whom who actually voted to get the present mayor, and our campaign to get rid of the position or the existing mayor. And quite frankly, it's not been good for the city at all.
But can you tell us practically how things have been difficult? What's been blocked? Because, I mean, we've got 70 councillors. Are they able to, you know, some might argue, well, hang on a minute, you've elected one mayor. Why do we need these 70 councillors?
Well, if you take the example of the residence parking zones as an example, the vast majority of councillors in at least two debates have actually pointed out the major problems. We've taken a vote on the first occasion, our views were fairly clear on the second one, and quite frankly, the views were just completely ignored. And we were representing the views of people across the city. So that's an example. We have managed to change the mayor's mind. I mean, I'm very glad that by mixture of sort of pressure and influence, we managed to persuade him not to abandon the Colston Hall, as an example. So we don't lose every time. But people were persuaded that things were not happening in Bristol. Firstly, that just wasn't true. I remember the examples that were quoted. We haven't got an arena. Well, quite frankly, we didn't have an arena. Nothing to do with the city council. The land was under the control of the regional development agency, or regional non-development agency, and quite frankly, they were unable to develop it. We were then complaining about two soccer stadiums, which again weren't being blocked by the city council, and they were affected by outside legislation which the city council had no control over at all. So people were whipped up into nothing's happening. Bristol was actually a very successful city. It still is for the moment, but it's actually
okay. All right, just wanted to give Helen Holland a chance to comment on this. Has the mayor been a success, Helen? And also the other question is about the change in the way we elect our local councillors, electing them every year next year for the first time.
Because we talk too much about the mayor, I'm noticing.
Well,
why is that?
We're out all the time, as I'm sure my colleagues are at the moment and have been for several months. And once the issue about local candidates has been dealt with, the one name that comes up on the doorstep more than any other is the current mayor's, and people saying, is it the mayoral election this time? Because they're definitely going to vote, and most of them make it very clear that they're going to be voting against the current mayor. So I think that there are some issues around the current mayor, and then there are issues about the mayoral system, and I'll just try and cover those very quickly. And one is that we're the only city with the model that we've got, so we can't have a referendum like other mayoral cities can in order to change the system. Now, that doesn't prejudge the outcome, but if we were able to have a referendum, people, electors could, if there were sufficient of them, you could have a referendum, and then people could say again whether or not they thought the mayoral system was working. And so that's one thing that needs to be fixed, and I think we've all had commitment from our national parties in Parliament to try and get that change, because Bristol is in a unique situation. And then there's this mayor, and I think that one of the things is that if you have got an all-powerful person in the middle, and as Tim said, it's a huge amount of power to be invested in one person. Most other places where they have mayoral systems, they have something that counterbalances that. And what we haven't seen, unfortunately, although there have been warm words, is a balancing of putting more power into the neighbourhood partnerships or whatever system you've got. And in Bristol we do have neighbourhood partnerships, which we've had consultations about giving more powers to the neighbourhood partnerships, but as yet we haven't really seen anything further come down. And that's the place where local councillors with their local communities can make a difference and can make the sorts of decisions that matter to people, probably more than some of the big strategic decisions about simple things like, you know, the programme of street maintenance, where people know which streets need doing first, and those things, they might sound small, but there are other examples of other places where there are far more decisions and bigger budgets given to local communities in order to keep that sense of balance that not everything that's happening is going on in the centre. Now, do I support moving to all-out elections? Yes, I do. And ironically, I think that had Bristol taken the decision probably 10 years ago to move to all-out elections, you might have had a different outcome on the referendum about whether or not we should move to a mayoral system, because of that perception that things weren't getting done. Although I have to agree with Gary on this one, that largely that was a perception that was fed by certain voices and certain, you know, certain quarters, and it didn't happen to be the case, and there had been a lot of progress made on a lot of areas. So I do support moving to all out elections. I think if we'd done it before, we might not be in the situation we're in now. But even though it's a bit frustrating talking to people at the moment, the talking to people isn't frustrating, but they feel a frustration that we've got only a third of the council and it's only for a year. But nevertheless, we are moving to that system, and it's right, I think personally, that it'll coincide with the mayoral election, so we'll have a new council, a new mayor, or re-elect elect a mayor next year.
Okay, the argument really for keeping the system the way it is it gives the public quite a regular opportunity every year or every couple of years to send a signal to the political parties, etc., about how they think they're doing, and that's going to go when we have them all, as we're calling, all out elections. Jeff Gollett, what's your thoughts about the success or otherwise of having a mayor in the city, and also, I suppose, this business of the changing of the local election system?
Well, I suppose I've got a vested interest as the mayor's deputy. But as a group, the Conservative Party campaigned for an elected mayor, and we did so because we didn't believe the system was working with a leader. Helen's alluded to the fact that part of the problem was elections every year, because it actually meant that we kept having a change of leader, and because we had elections every year, those who were incumbent were inevitably thinking about the potential impact of any decision they made on the next set of elections. And Bristol needed some firm leadership. And what I believe we've seen with the elected mayor is that we have seen decisions being taken, actions being implemented, not all of which, I hasten to add, do I agree with in the slightest. But I actually believe our city needs leading, even if those decisions aren't always the right ones. They need to be made with real conviction. And that was largely the problem. If you visit other major cities, yes, they do have parking zones. They also have transport schemes. They also have arenas. And they also have lots of spending on infrastructure. We didn't have it because at no stage could a leader ever be in position long enough to actually see a policy through and make it happen. And hearing Garrett's sort of rose-tinted spin on what he has to say, you know, it is not as simple as being in a position and debating and hearing all the fors and against. We have a danger that we spend so much time seeking views of stakeholders that we end up losing the opportunity to make the decision. Now, that's not a reason for consulting, quite the opposite. It's not a reason for consulting effectively and quickly and getting on and making those decisions. And I actually see the elected mayor has taken the initiative, has started things happening, and there is a buzz about the city now that there was not some years ago.
I have to say, with regard to the transport, the reason that Bristol and the surrounding councils were suffering in terms of lack of investment is centralised government decision making, but we'd failed in the past to cooperate with the neighbours. We'd actually, over the last few years, been working very, very effectively with our neighbouring authorities, attracting large amounts of government money, but I'm afraid the relationship with the surrounding councils has now started to go backwards a little, which is very unfortunate.
Excuse me, we've just been joined by Michael Frost from UK Independence Party. Could you give us your thoughts about whether you think the mayor system in Bristol works and whether there's any point in electing councillors when you've got a mayor who makes all the decisions? All they are, it seems to me, at least some people say, is just advisers to the mayor.
Well, we have no democracy in Bristol anymore. That's my big concern. I'm a relatively new councillor. I've only been in post for a year, so I've sat there observing how things are done. And I couldn't make head and tail of it when I first sat down, because I thought, well, there's all these councillors that have been elected by their wards to represent their wards, and we've got this elected mayor and his cronies who are deciding what's done and what not's done. And as Councillor Gollop said, although whether we agree or disagree with them, we can do nothing about it. My other concern was that when the mayoral election took place, and maybe you can correct me on 1 or 2%, but I believe only 28% of Bristolians actually voted, and George Ferguson was elected by 14% of that vote. So I don't think he's got a mandate. That's my own personal opinion. I also think, and a lot of people complain about this, and I might sound a bit fuddy-duddy, but I think the way that he presents himself to dignitaries and places that he has to go and people that he has to see, he looks like a scruffy little asylum seeker that's got dressed in a pound shop. And I am appalled with his appearance.
But, I mean, surely you said there's no democracy. I mean, this was a perfectly democratic election that elected George Ferguson, and he's the mayor. Why is that not democratic?
Well, because there wasn't enough people that actually voted.
But that's their choice.
Yeah, true. And I think they're probably regretting it now. Now, I'll take your point. He was democratically elected. I'm not going to argue against that.
No, I was just going to say, I've been a councillor for 14 years, and I've been a member of the third party the whole of that time. But that doesn't mean there isn't democracy at work. It doesn't mean when Helen was leading the council that I couldn't have discussions with Helen about things that affected my ward. And I can still do that, and I have done that with leaders and different parties in control, and I can do it now. We're sat opposite Tim. Tim in his first year has chaired the Business Change Scrutiny Commission and made a really positive contribution to the way the council makes some of its major business decisions. So actually, I accept there are flaws in the system. I accept there are issues about accountability and about all the power being in one place. I'm not going to pretend that isn't the case, but to actually say that democracy doesn't work, I think is wrong. I think we've got strong democracy where... Helen's point about neighbourhood partnerships is absolutely key, is that in the areas where the strongest and most powerful mayors have been most successful, they've done it on the back of strong local communities having strong views and strong delegated powers to those communities. And so I believe we're only at the start of rolling this model out, and we've got to pass that power down to the people who really know, which is those at the grassroots. It shouldn't be decisions coming from City Hall outwards. It should be views coming from neighbourhood partnerships upwards, because those are the people who know when their grass needs cutting, when the bins need emptying, and when the potholes need filling, not someone sat behind a desk developing a desktop theory of how it should operate.
See, this is the worry, isn't it? If it's one person making these decisions, it could be sort of ivory tower syndrome, where people... Can I just remind everybody that we do have a £370 million annual budget. That's what we're talking about today, is about how it's spent, how decisions are made, about how that £370 million of our money is spent. Tim, you wanted to come in there.
Well, I was just going to build on this. Once I get over Michael's first thought about someone looks scruffy being an asylum seeker, which I thought was extraordinary in your first 30 seconds to bring out that particular metaphor.
Well, to be fair, it wasn't in the first 30 seconds.
Like a mayor of a major British city.
I've been sitting here thinking, should I name this? But I'm sorry, I think your first metaphor of someone who looks scruffy choosing that to be an asylum seeker, it just ticks all the stereotypes.
Well, I don't think many people take a lot of notice of what Green say.
Yeah, can you get to the point
maybe
about
not.
The mayor then, Tim?
Okay, I will, but I'm sorry, I chose to say that because I wanted to say that. I think building on Jeff...
you look like an asylum seeker.
Hang on.
So building on Jeff's point, I think this is important. You know, it's not black and white and clear cut, and I think the mayor has learned over his term so far to be more receptive. He comes from business rather than politics, which is a different way of getting things to happen. But just to point out the right of recall that we have, two very recent cabinet decisions, both on raising revenue through digital advertising and selling off the port, so that's about how money works in this city. Big decisions were actually recalled by different groups of councillors saying, hang on, we're not happy with this decision, we want you to have another look at it. So I think that's another example, as is scrutiny, of where councillors still do have the opportunity to really call the mayor to question.
But the likelihood is, although both of those calling committees decided to take the, you know, the highest action that they can take, which is to refer a matter back to council, they could refer it back to the mayor. The mayor, having made the decision in the first place, we know is unlikely to revisit his own decision, could refer it back to cabinet. Again, the mayor is in effect the only voting member of cabinet, because the rest of the cabinet are there in an advisory capacity, or take it back to council. Now, I'm not again going to prejudge what the outcome of those discussions is when those two issues come back to council, but the fact is that even if all 70 of us, or the new council, vote to say this isn't the right decision, the mayor can still override that.
I agree, and that'll be the proof of the pudding, how he listens, and whether he's learning to listen
well,
better or not.
Well, I'll give you an example of that.
Paul Innes at the moment are, you know, it's a good mechanism because it makes officers answer questions that perhaps they should have answered the first time around and didn't. It gives the chance to air the debate again, but it doesn't assume that there's a different decision's going to come out at the end of it.
No, and I think the quality of the listening was actually demonstrated, because when the call-in on the Docks decision was actually proceeding, and there was a very good debate, the mayor bailed out halfway through the meeting because he stopped listening.
Can you just tell us what the Docks debate was about, Gary? Remind people that don't know.
Some years ago, the city actually got a very good deal when the Docks were actually put into private ownership for running, but we retained the freehold, so we retained some small rights over the Docks. They've done a good job of running it, made a good profit, but now the mayor wants to sell off the freehold, which means that we lose control in some areas, and if the freehold is actually sold, there's a significant danger of the then married values being sold off elsewhere, so not doing what the city needs to do. And when also the deal does not have a sell-on clause, which brings money back into the city council. So if the owners then sell on at a vast profit, the city council and therefore the taxpayers do not get a proper share of that profit.
Okay, well, one of the groups that's standing in the local elections, which isn't represented around the table today, is the Independents for Bristol candidates. And we're going to hear now from one of those. That's Dawn Parry.
I'm Dawn Parry. I'm the parliamentary candidate for Bristol West, and I'm standing for independence for Bristol.
Now, it's a bit confusing for many people because we've got a so-called independent mayor. In what way are you independent, and are you linked to the mayor?
No, I'm not linked to the mayor. We are both independent of each other and independent of every party and all political dogma. I know the mayor and I like a lot of his decisions, and I have been happy to support him, but I'm not linked. And Independence for Bristol is only a facilitator. It's not a group of policy wonks or policy makers or anything like that.
Okay, so what do you stand for? It's all very well saying, well, I'm independent, but you must have some kind of programme.
I do. One of the first things that I feel is pretty important is legalising job share MP status for a start, because we don't have enough female representation, and I don't believe that under the current system we're ever going to get enough female representation. We've only got 22% of females in power at the moment. When I say in power, in Parliament, elected to Parliament, and there are 51% of us in the populace en masse. And we have, we're so underrepresented with regard to any form of disability, for example. We don't really have many disabled MPs. So I just think if we could legalise the job share status, then it would be possible to have many more kind of gender inequality balanced stuff in Parliament.
Now, Independence for Bristol's got its own logo, it's its own kind of thing, it's also an independent mayor. I think, isn't it a bit confusing for people because, you know, you've got lots of people who are all independent, but they all use the same kind of badge. That sounds like its own political party.
But there aren't lots of people using the same badge at all. If you recall, George First went out, I think it was under Bristol First, and then eventually I believe he dropped that as well, and it's just George Ferguson as an independent. Now, I'm using the backing of Independence for Bristol because I need the assistance of lawyers and people like that. And this is, as I say, just a facilitator. It's not some sort of army of people with an agenda. So it's allowing me to have completely my own personal ideas on what feels right for Bristol West.
Is it only the fact that it's independence that's bringing people together, or is there anything that sort of you could say all independents for Bristol stand for this?
Oh, no, 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 no. All independents for Bristol do not stand for any one specific thing. And that is the beauty of being an independent within Independents for Bristol. We agree to disagree on things. We're not each other's keepers. And I'm the only one standing for Parliament for a start. We have several standing for council seats, but each one of them is very unique, and their whole policy ideas and framework are unique to them.
Are there any threads that run right the way through the Independents for Bristol other than being independent from the main political party?
Well, I think with most of us there's quite a left-leaning, but there are one or two who are not left-leaning, but they're, you know, and they're free to do that. That is what independence
is about.
What
ultimately is, you think, the problem with the existing political parties then? Why does that model not work for you?
because it's all for one lot, and then that one lot not really for all the rest of us. And I feel there is an incredible lack of flexibility as well. And we can't... the other thing is, by the way, they're all the same now. How do you put a cigarette paper even, or actually I'd prefer to use dental floss, but how do you get dental floss between any one of them? It's very difficult. I'm standing for Transport for Bristol. I believe that we need a not-for-profit group, because... so I'm currently working with the Bristol People's Bus Company, which is a small group of us, independents, again, not political at all, but this is a not-for-profit bus service for Bristol, to be run by the people of Bristol for Bristol users, because what we currently have doesn't actually work and doesn't accommodate for all of us, but it does line the pockets of very large national companies. So I stand for Greta Transport. I also stand for a far more creative solution to our housing problems. We have many, many office blocks all over Bristol West that are empty. At the same time, at this very moment, we've got about 176 families right now, children with their parents and so on, who are homeless, being housed in not great bed and breakfasts, and being paid for by our taxes, you know, by the local government. So I think it's important that we sort out housing. We've got a serious housing issue. It's very expensive. Our rental market also needs to be looked after and regulated properly.
Okay, how would you bring rents down, though?
Well, I think now this is going to be something that, you know, people certainly outside of Bristol West won't like the sound of, but I think we have got to have a look at estate agents and the way that they are allowing people from abroad with buckets and buckets of money to blindly buy our properties, which they're doing through auctions. They're not even seeing the properties.
But how can you stop them doing that? They could sell to anybody, aren't they?
Well, of course they can. I realise that, but we have to address this housing issue somehow. And if there is a way, for example, if we were to say to those people, going back to the regulation side of things, if you buy this property, you will not be able to let it out immediately, or you won't be able to let it for 1 year or something like that. Make these people sit on the amount of money that they're spending, and because they're pushing our prices up, and us, we Indigenous people within Bristol West, can't afford to live here.
That was Dawn Parry there, Independence for Bristol candidate. She's one of those standing in the general election, but there are several standing in the local elections too. And I'm joined around the table by Conservatives, Labour, Lib Dem, Greens and UK Independence Party. That is to say, we've got Jeff Gollop for the Conservatives, Helen Holland for Labour, Gary Hopkins for the Lib Dems, Tim Malnick for Greens, and Michael Frost for UK Independence Party. Now, I've got a bit of a quiz for you all here, folks. I thought we'd have a go at that, which is how many police do you think we've lost in Avon and Somerset Police since the new coalition government came in? Because I was quite shocked when I saw the figure, and I wonder if anyone around the table would like to hazard a guess.
I'd hazard a guess for Avon and Somerset being about 360, and that's particularly concerning because Avon and Somerset was unfairly treated on the national formula beforehand. So some forces probably could afford to lose officers far more than Avon and Somerset.
Okay, so Gary's saying 360 officers lost. Anyone else like to guess?
I'd say around about 500.
500?
The most important one we lost was the actual police commissioner, which... has turned into a running sore and still hasn't been resolved.
You mean the Chief Constable? You're talking about the Chief Constable?
Yes.
Okay. Anyone else like to guess? Jeff? Come on. Helen? No?
I have not
Tim?
A clue.
Well, the actual figure is 600 police we've lost, and that is actually 18% of the total in Avon and Somerset Police officers lost since 2010, with the government cuts. There's a total of 3,350 police officers in Avon and Somerset. I just think this is quite a good way into the debate and discussion about the actual effects on the cuts, because I get quite frustrated being told again and again, well, we're not cutting frontline services. Quite obviously, if you're getting rid of nearly 20% of your police officers, you are cutting frontline services. I'd just like to start with you, Helen, this time, on what you think can be done in the city and what your party would like to do about the cuts, the whole austerity.
Well, let's start on policing, because although I didn't know the number, it doesn't surprise me, because we know that obviously there are posts that are going unfilled in our local communities. And I think that the heart of a safe community is people feeling that they've got confidence that if they ring the police that somebody's going to come if it's a serious matter. And I think that what we've seen is that there's a frustration amongst people which has the effect of them not wanting to ring because they believe that the police aren't interested in their issues, and that reduces the amount of call out. So we have a situation where actually I'm sure that other councillors have found this. It's at your neighbourhood partnership, you get the police coming and they give you the crime stats for your area for the last quarter. And many a time, the residents feel quite incredulous that the figures are as low as they are. And
if you don't mind me interrupting, I'd just like to give some of those statistics and the way that they've changed since 2010. Response times have risen over the last 4 years. Percentage of urban emergency calls on target has reduced from 93% to 88%. That's, you know, police arriving within 15 minutes for urban calls, and from 88%, because obviously quite a lot of Avon and Somerset's rural, from 8 down to 83% for the rural calls, which are expected, police are expected to be there within 20 minutes. Fewer priority calls have been attended on target as well. That's down from 77% to 69%. So there's big falls in all areas.
And the City Council, when we were in charge, we put extra money in to fund additional police community support officers, the PCSOs, who do so much of that pavement work that is gets the confidence of those communities. The City Council doesn't pay that money any longer. There are less PCSOs. There have been other decisions that have affected the work patterns of those PCSOs. For example, in my own patch, Bishopsworth Police Station has been closed. They used to be based there, the ones in our neighbourhood area. They now come from Broadbury Road, but they haven't got vehicles, so half of their time is spent getting from Broadbury Road into Hartcliffe and Willywood. And you can see that. So where there is resource, it's not always being directed in the best way possible.
Okay, I'm going to come to you next, Michael Frost, because you won the our little quiz, guessing 500, actually it's 600, police officers have been lost since 2010. What would you like to see done about this?
Well, I think it's appalling that the city isn't being policed effectively. I've actually been burgled twice since I've lived in Bristol, and each time the police turn up, they more or less tell you they've got little or no chance of finding out who's done it. They give you a victims of crime leaflet, and that's about it. You hardly see, and I'm not talking about the old Dixon or Doc Green and get them all back on the beat, because that's not really effective in a modern city either, but the money that is wasted on vanity projects that could be put into effective policing, the £2.5 million it costs to reduce the speed limits to 20 miles an hour, which is mostly ignored by everybody, complete waste of money to do that. And we just don't have enough police on the streets, whether the people feel safe or not. I don't actually feel safe.
But this is a symptom, isn't it, really, of the cuts. We've been told many of the cuts are being brought in. They're not frontline services. This clearly is a frontline service.
How can anybody say that policing isn't a frontline service?
Well, I would imagine they will argue that this is backroom staff that would have been made redundant or whatever, rather than frontline. Anyway, Tim Malnick, what's your thoughts about...
Can I just make another point before you move on? If you go out on the streets and you talk to people and you ask them the question that you've just asked me, then the answers you'll get will be quite shocking, because a lot of people don't feel safe anymore.
So your question, I think, is about cuts.
It's about cuts
services.
And it's about policing.
Right.
Yeah.
So in terms of cuts, clearly it's a national issue. We have to deal as best we can. And as Jeff says, I've been involved in scrutinising the budget this year. There's less and less slack. It's absolutely clear for everything the council has to do, there's less and less money. It's clear to me that frontline services are being affected in all sorts of ways, and there's other bits of budget. So I'm talking to very successful, excellent local schools that are saying we can only afford as a strategy to employ very young teachers, because as soon as they get experience they cost too much and we won't be able to actually run the school effectively. And it's also clear, talking to all sorts of people in the city trying to do all sorts of things through the council, that for the last couple of years, as officers have left, relationships have broken broken down, projects have left. So a lot of expertise walked out the door. So the thing to say, as a national issue, and we may get into this, but clearly the Green Party doesn't think austerity policies work. We don't think the cuts are worth it. We do think they impact hugely on society in all sorts of areas.
Okay, so where do you find the money? That's the next question, isn't it?
Well, I've got a whole printout here, and without boring everyone with the details, it's clear, you know, as a general principle, we would say that the pain isn't worth it. The benefit of reducing or being focused as an administration purely on one metric, which is a budget deficit, doesn't make sense. We would have a wealth tax. We would have a financial transaction tax. We would have a shift onto energy taxes. So you use taxation not just to raise revenue, but to start to discourage all sorts of behaviours that all the parties say they don't want people to do. So it's a long answer, but okay, have a look at our manifesto.
Thanks,
it's an approach.
Gary Hopkins for the Dems.
I think I agree with the Guardian on this one, that the Green Party used to be quite useful until they entered financial la-la land, and the Independent have said exactly the same thing as well.
So there's nothing that can be done about the cuts then?
Well, in actual fact, as I say, they've got to be more carefully thought through. So some police forces could have absorbed the cuts more easily than Avon and Somerset's been able to, because it was unfairly treated before. A lot of the work that was actually done in Bristol over a number of years, through, say, for Bristol Partnership, where the agencies came together, actually managed to produce some phenomenally good results without spending a huge amount of extra money. So, for example, you effectively treat a drug addict and get them off drugs. That saves a huge amount of time and money, because they're not breaking into 20 cars a week to try and pay for their habit. So the way that you do things also can make a huge difference.
Okay, Gary, sorry to stop you there, but we want to hear Jeff before we get to the news. Jeff, what's your thoughts about the cuts? Because, right, you know, we are clearly seeing some serious problems with 20% of our police nearly disappearing over the last few years.
Yeah, I mean, look, the first thing is we've got to live in the real world. And I think across the main parties there is a recognition that, that austerity is upon us, and we're not going to get away from it instantly just by pretending it's not there. So just spending money for the sake of it isn't the answer. But I do accept that in the Westminster bubble, it's a lot easier to inflict cuts on things that are remote from Westminster, and therefore local authorities and police forces may be suffering disproportionately. In Bristol, we've very much had the philosophy that we must try and maintain as much as we can the services that we deliver. Now, it doesn't say in every case we've done that, but that actually delivering the services but working out how we can deliver them more effectively is a very important measure. And I think we have real concerns with the police delivery, because Helen's right, the PCSOs may not be contributing to the international and business crime statistics, but in terms of giving confidence to local residents, they give a feeling that there is someone there, there's someone caring, there's someone giving support. And you know, it is actually about the confidence that people feel. And we've got to think about our elderly residents who actually are frightened to go out. Real or perceived is actually the fact that we have got to give them the confidence to believe that they can do that. And so when
Jeff,
I talk about
just one question, because we're coming up to the news now. Finally, has the mayor been batting enough up at Westminster? Yes or no?
He's been batting,
yes,
for Bristol.
No?
He's been batting for Bristol, but he's not batting for the police commissioner.
Well, most people around the table are saying no. Anyway, we're going into the news now. We're back after the news,
this is
Bristol.
Yeah,
so we're doing
BCFM
our local election debate. See you after the news for another hour.
Online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.